From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke is reporting in China this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
With Charles Gibson.
Good evening. It has been a day of behind-the-scenes drama in the presidential race. And
so what does Hillary want? What are her demands? Is she negotiating now with Barack Obama?
Turning now to politics, Hillary Clinton's campaign said today she is not actively seeking the vice presidential nomination.
All but buried in the avalanche of coverage this week on the end of the Democratic primaries and the historic victory of Senator Barack Obama over Senator Hillary Clinton was another White House challenge in the U.S. Senate, this one between the Intelligence Committee and the Bush administration. After years of partisan gamesmanship, a five-year committee investigation into the selling of the Iraq War concluded that the president and his subordinates exaggerated Saddam Hussein's threat beyond his own borders, leading to an invasion based on what Senator Jay Rockefeller called false premises. The report was especially critical of the administration's continued assertions of a connection, never substantiated, between Saddam and the plotters of 9/11. For instance, this September 2003 talking point, mouthed by then-presidential press secretary Scott McClellan.
We do know that there is a long history of Saddam Hussein and his regime and ties to terrorism, including al-Qaeda.
The Senate report had a certain too-obvious, too-late quality to it, but it did dovetail nicely with the other big Washington political story of the week, McClellan's own media tour promoting his new memoir, What Happened, which portrays a naive, idealistic public servant, partly victimized and partly corrupted by the cynical world of presidential politics. He joins me now. Scott, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be with you, Bob. Thanks for having me on today.
So the media are disgusted with you for fronting for liars. Your White House friends think you're a traitor. How's this being an author thing working out for you this week, Scott?
Well, I tell you, there's been a lot of supportive words out there that from people on the street as well as even former colleagues that have quietly emailed me with their words of encouragement. You know, I expected the reaction to some extent. I was surprised by how personal some of it was. But at the same time, I think people have had a chance to hear from me and see the larger message in the book about the need to change the way Washington governs.
Larger messages to follow. First, I want to ask you about the White House reaction, because it's been a veritable choreography of pity for you. Here, courtesy of The Daily Show, is what it sounded like all week.
This is not the Scott we knew.
It's just inconsistent with the individual that we knew is Scott McClellan, the press secretary.
Maybe this is a new Scott.
The voice that comes out of this book is certainly not Scott McClellan's.
It's that Scott has said things that really don't, one, sound like Scott, frankly.
This doesn't sound like Scott.
So you've basically had your soul sucked out by the liberal publishing industry and replaced with a demon spirit, Scott.
Yeah, apparently I'm having an out-of-body experience.
Okay, so describe for me, please, the discrediting process in the White House. Confronted with your book, how did those talking points about this not being the Scott that they know, how did they come to life?
Oh, I imagine pretty quickly after the first news report aired about the book, there was some internal discussion within the communications team, maybe some others, about how to respond. They developed some talking points and probably sent those out to White House allies as well. In fact, it's evident that they sent them out to White House allies as well to echo that message, and they immediately went to work trying to discredit what I had to say.
Who is on the list?
Well, I think it includes conservative commentators on radio, conservative commentators on the airwaves, conservative columnists in newspapers. It's a wide distribution list that the White House has the ability to send to through the Office of Strategic Initiatives, one of the political arms of the White House that works in close coordination with the Office of Communications at times like this. And so it's a very well choreographed effort.
Now, we were talking about the meeting where the talking points were contrived. You've been in meetings just like that, have you not?
I have, absolutely.
You, in your book, criticize this approach to spokesmanship. You call it the perpetual campaign mentality, everything that comes from the administration being spun for political advantage. What would have happened had you sat in one of those meetings and said, well, here's an idea for what we can say, the truth?
looking back on it, I took over when I was fairly young, first as deputy press secretary, then as press secretary. You know, I got caught up in playing this Washington game, the permanent campaign mentality, just like so many others that come here. And that's what the larger theme of the book is about. And that's what the problem is with Washington. It's a cultural problem that is deep-seated, that is inherently deceptive. Most of it is harmless or incidental. But when that permanent campaign mentality gets transferred over into the war-making process, that's when it becomes particularly problematic and very troubling, because the American people, on an issue as grave as war, must have the truths about the situation and what the realities are as best we can know them.
Let's talk about the war. You've admitted that you were passing along, at least, lies from Scooter Libby and Karl Rove about the Valerie Plame affair.
Unknowingly, yes.
But what about other White House lies, that Saddam and 9/11 were somehow connected, that waterboarding is somehow not torture?
He does not condone torture, and he has never authorized the use of torture. The president has made that very clear in the past, and he continues to hold that view because we are a nation of certain laws and certain values, and torture is not consistent with our values and with our laws.
You stood up there and mouthed that kind of stuff again and again and again. Have you reevaluated those talking points as well?
Well, some of that. I mean, I think on the 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, obviously the vice president was the one that was furthest out on trying to draw a connection there with the Mohammed Atta meeting in Prague. You know, in my view, what I was saying was sincere at the time, but some of it was badly misguided. On the waterboarding issue, I now look back on that, and I didn't know the specifics about that. I wasn't briefed into that from a classification standpoint, but I was told by others in the administration that it's not torture, and I did go out and defend that, and some actually in the administration view it that way. They view what they were telling me as the truth. I don't see how, stepping back from it and knowing what we know now about that, that you can view it as anything but torture.
What was your job? Spokesman for the government?
Spokesman for the president, for the White House, the face of the administration, someone who's there to advocate and defend the president's decisions and policies, someone who doesn't get to pick and choose what he says. He is there advocating on the behalf of the president.
Let me come up with the term, and you tell me if it's accurate. Instead of being the spokesman for the government, how about political operative?
Well, I think that there, you know, certainly part of my background was in politics. But the press secretary has to always remember that their ultimate obligation is to the American people. And sometimes you can get inside that White House, and sometimes that mindset can be clouded by events and circumstances.
Well, Scott, forgive me, but you've been talking about being caught up in the process of the politics of destruction and the perpetual campaign mentality. But just a second ago, what you described is not someone who is caught up and culpable, but somebody who is out there naked and unprotected, uninformed, and fundamentally a stooge. Were you
a
stooge?
Well, at times it can be that way. But it was one of the concerns I had when I initially accepted the job, but before it was announced. I had to take some time thinking about it because I was coming in when we were moving into an election year period, and I knew that the White House didn't want to change much. And I was concerned, and I write about this in a chapter in the book, you know, whether or not I would have the flexibility I needed to do the job the way I wanted to do it. And I don't think I really ever did. Looking back on it, maybe I would have done something differently, and I certainly should have done some things differently at certain times.
But you didn't leave for some good while, in fact, until you were fired by Josh Bolton, the chief of staff. Why didn't you quit?
Right. I became increasingly disillusioned in the last 10 months. I actually considered leaving at that time, but it wasn't the president who, as far as I know, and I don't believe he did, I believe he was misled too on that incident, that misled me. So that's part of the reason. But then when I learned in early April 2006 that the president had secretly declassified parts of the National Intelligence Estimate, that became very disillusioning because we had been out there decrying the selective leaking of classified information, and here the president had done it on his own, with only the vice president and Scooter Libby being the ones who knew about that. That was when I had essentially made the decision, well, I think it's probably time for me to move on. I'll do it in a couple of months here, and I'll move on to something else.
Well, for all the hubbub that has resulted from the publication of your book, it's actually quite gentle on the administration, at least on the president himself. But now that you've had a chance for reflection, do you believe that you were, in effect, fronting for a bunch of scoundrels?
No, I don't. I think that's too broad of a statement. Most of these people are good people at heart. It's not something sinister in my view. I know others might view it as something that is sinister, but I view it as something that is a cultural problem that has become too accepted in Washington, D.C. And the most important thing we can do to move beyond it all is for a president to embrace a high level of openness and candor. And this administration has not done that.
The book is titled What Happened. Scott, what did happen?
This administration went terribly off course. I was a young, idealistic, political person who went to join Governor Bush's staff thinking he could bring that same sort of 70% plus approval rating and bipartisan spirit to Washington, but it didn't happen. The president, I think, was too focused from the beginning on building a massive political operation that had too much influence, and there wasn't enough counterbalance to that influence, and that's why I proposed some ideas about how to counterbalance the political influence that is always going to exist in any White House.
All right, Scott. Thank you very much for joining me.
Bob, it was great to be on the show. Thanks.
Former presidential spokesman Scott McClellan is the author of What Happened.
The National Intelligence Estimate was a document that was provided to members of Congress. It is the collective judgment of the intelligence community. And because of the public debate that was going on and some of the wild accusations that were flying around at the time, we felt it was very much in the public interest that what information could be declassified, be declassified, and that's exactly what we did.
As I mentioned at the top, Brooke Gladstone is in China with two OTM producers working on a special report for the last week of June. The long-planned trip came, at least for the purposes of news gathering, at a propitious moment, on the heels of Tibetan unrest and a catastrophic earthquake, and just in advance of the Summer Olympics, where the repressive regime hopes to showcase the fruits of its fast-growing economy for a worldwide audience. We hope you'll tune in. Meantime, Brooke, Megan Ryan, and Jamie York are keeping us up to date on the OTM China blog. To follow their progress, just log in to onthemedia.org. Coming up, take that, Fox News Channel. Here come the Huffington Post and MSNBC. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Once upon a time, there was the cable news network, CNN. Then came Fox News Channel, offering a fair and balanced 24-hour PR forum for the Republican National Committee. And then there arrived MSNBC, which was, well, who knew what it was, besides unimposing and largely unwatched. For years, it languished as a distant third, but it is distant no longer. On the strength of its primary election coverage and on the emergence of primetime anchor Keith Olbermann, MSNBC has become a force to be reckoned with. On Tuesday, it outpulled Fox by 200,000 viewers, and in the coveted demographic of viewers aged 25 to 54, MSNBC trounced Fox by 37%. Brian Stelter, who covers all things TV for the New York Times, says this has partly to do with the general ascendancy of cable, but also partly with this.
You, Mr. Bush, are a bald-faced liar, convicted by your own deliberate lies. You, sir, have no business being president. When somebody asks you, sir, about Democrats who must now pull this country back from the abyss you have placed us at, when somebody asks you, sir, about your gallant, noble, self-abnegating sacrifice of your golf game so as to soothe the families of the war dead, this advice, Mr. Bush, shut the hell up.
You know, the ratings for MSNBC and especially for Keith Olbermann have been growing slowly and steadily for the past couple of years. But executives at NBC say this was the year. This is the breakout time for that network. Now, the ratings may not stick around after the election. We saw that happen to MSNBC in 2000 as well. But for one of the first times in the network's history, they've found their voice. And it's a very passionate, very involved, and a significantly left-of-center voice.
It seems to me that this occurred at approximately the time Keith Olbermann started going after the Bush administration and being openly partisan on TV.
It did indeed. It is new to have an anchor who has called for President Bush's impeachment and who has condemned Hillary Clinton's campaigning tactics at one point to be the lead anchor of election nights. But the viewers have responded to that more opinionated, more electrified type of coverage. MSNBC's ratings are sometimes beating Fox News ratings on big primary nights, which I think a lot of people would be shocked to see a year ago.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Fox News because more than any other cable channel, they have benefited from the programming of ideology. But they're also, as a consequence, not taken especially seriously across the political spectrum as a news organization. Does MSNBC risk the similar marginalization by attaching itself to such a partisan poster boy?
There's definitely a concern, and I think it's more from the outside than it is from the inside at NBC, that MSNBC could be viewed as a political liability to the network and to General Electric. We saw a big report in the Washington Post a few weeks ago about how Fox News and Bill O'Reilly have been targeting Keith Olbermann and MSNBC for a supposed left-wing viewpoint, and how they've actually been going after General Electric, the parent company of NBC, as a way to put pressure on the network to quiet Keith Olbermann or tamp him down. We saw throughout the primary season Hillary Clinton's campaign aide suggesting that MSNBC was in the tank for Obama, and no news organization wants to be perceived, rightly or wrongly, as being supportive of one particular candidate or one particular party. So I am curious to see in the next 5 or 6 months here how MSNBC is perceived and whether these higher ratings can also come with a downside.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Stelter covers television for The New York Times. Phil Griffin is the executive in charge of MSNBC. He says Keith Olbermann's opinionation is neither the sole explanation for MSNBC's recent success nor a threat to its credibility.
After the 2004 election, Keith Olbermann is basically the same guy he is today. He didn't exactly hit it out of the park in terms of ratings. Same guy, but I do think the stars began to align differently going into the midterms in 2006. People started to tune into Olbermann. The country changed.
Olbermann has had a lot of success because he's a hammer banging a nail, and that nail is the Bush administration. But the Bush administration is not long for this world. And let's just assume for a moment that Obama is elected. And let's further assume that his goals of a whole new way of conducting government are realized. There goes the nail. What happens to Keith Olbermann? And has he kind of lost his raison d'etre?
I don't think so. Keith is a broader spectrum than just beating up on the Bush administration. Keith holds the feet of power to the fire. And I assume he will continue to credit those that deserve credit and criticize those that don't. I've encouraged from the beginning our anchors and our hosts to be authentic. I want their point of view, a wide range of guests. And yes, we have a couple of strong-willed people on our air right now. And I'm sure in the next few years it'll change as administrations change and as issues change. But that's what I want this station to be, a place where you have this great exchange of the ideas of the day.
I want to ask you about the strategic risk of doing things this way, because you've got in Olbermann a guy who is, you know, in some ways the anti-O'Reilly. Is there no risk attached to contaminating the neutrality, the objectivity of someone like Brian Williams and Tim Russert?
Point to one time you thought Tim Russert, Brian Williams, Tom Brokaw, Andrea Mitchell hurt themselves by being on MSNBC. They come on, they are themselves, they know who they are, they're the best journalists in the business. You point to me one time you think they may have hurt themselves by being on MSNBC.
But in a way, you haven't really answered the question, because I'm asking you whether the totality of NBC News' image can be endangered if Keith Olbermann is perceived as just the O'Reilly of the left.
I think the audience gets it. I think they're smart enough to figure out the roles people play. Is Chris and Keith a little different on those nights than on their shows? Totally. They've got to be. And I think we give the audience the credit. They get it. We've had the most successful half year in MSNBC history. And Tim Russert continues to dominate on Sunday mornings. And Nightly News continues to dominate. This is a great time at NBC News. It used to be the sort of stinky poo MSNBC. We moved into 30 Rock. And then all of a sudden, everybody at NBC News wanted to play on our channel. Brian and Tim and Andrea down the list. And that was a first. There are two things going on here. The news game is more and more being played on cable. Two, you get much more time in cable. When Tim Russert raised his hand and said, you know what? My voice can be heard on MSNBC during the primary seasons. The guys at ABC and CBS would love to have an opportunity that Tim has, but they don't have a place to go. He did.
All right, Phil. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Phil Griffin is executive in charge of MSNBC. If MSNBC is a profiteer in the George W. Bush hatred industry, it has plenty of company. Scott McClellan's What Happened is merely the latest among dozens of literary exposés about the administration. Michael Moore is but one of a dozen film documentarians who have savaged the president. And then there is the blogosphere, where the Daily Kos, the Talking Points Memo, and perhaps most famously the Huffington Post have made the White House and the Republican Party anvils for their e-hammering. Now blog founder Arianna Huffington has taken her thoroughgoing disgust old school with a book of her own. It's titled Right is Wrong, and along the way to savaging the Republicans for crimes against democracy, she finds accessories before and after the fact in the media.
We are obsessed with presenting every issue as having two sides and assuming that the difference between the two sides is where the truth lies. Well, in fact, as we know very well, very often the truth is on one side or the other. Yet the way the media present issues, whether it's global warming or Iraq or indeed evolution and creationism, is becoming amoral. It's as though there is no truth. It's a little bit like Pontius Pilate washing his hands of responsibility. And that's supposed to be balance. That's supposed to be objectivity. In fact, it's really making it much harder for the American public to recognize where the truth lies.
You talk about zombie lies, which is a clever coinage, not yours, I guess, but that concerns the media's inability to impeach lies that are so big that no matter how many times they're addressed, the public still clings to them, such as the connection between Saddam and 9/11. But in defense of the media, I have read the refutation of that zombie lie hundreds, maybe thousands of times. Is the media to blame that people believe what they want to believe?
No, of course not. The point I'm making here is if you go back and look at all the thousands of times that the media allowed someone to make that connection and let them go unchallenged, that is what made it more likely that people in America would believe that.
This idea of accepting spin as legitimate balance is so institutionalized, you point out, that people like Tim Russert of NBC's Meet the Press actually anticipate it in their interviews and wind up serving as proxies for some disingenuous politico. He uses the phrase, critics will say. Tell me about critics will say.
Yes, critics will say is the way that many in the media, including Tim Russert, try to bring that fake balance. Very often, critics will say is the spin of the administration in the last 7.5 years. And it's not surprising that Kathy Martin, who was the communications director in Cheney's office, called Meet the Press our quote-unquote best format because we can quote-unquote control the message.
Well, no. One of the reasons the White House and most other political figures prefer the Sunday talk show format is because it's unedited. And if a question is asked, they can not answer it. So in that sense, they control the message, not because they're pulling the strings of the Tim Russert puppet.
I think they control the message because of the lack of critical follow-up questions. I mean, you know as an interviewer that anybody you're likely to want to interview would be able to answer your first question. The question is, how do they answer your second and third probing questions? And that's what is often missing.
I want to talk to you for a moment about the Huffington Post. There has been this endless search for a new model, for a way to build a newspaper on the internet that not only attracts an audience, but which is profitable. You have attracted quite an audience to the Huffington Post. Is it true that you're on the verge of actually making money?
Yes, we are, through advertising. Advertising, as you know, is increasingly migrating online. I, incidentally, have never argued that newspapers are going to die. I don't see it as an either-or proposition. I see it more as a three-way, you know, as, remember the old barroom argument, is it going to be Ginger, is it going to be Marianne? I say, why not both? Why not both print that also has an online component, as every news operation must, and new media that increasingly, like the Huffington Post, are moving into more reporting and therefore more of a convergence, the creation of hybrids rather than either-or propositions.
Now, in your book, you take a few shots at Fox News Channel, and duh, they are clearly the house organ of the right wing and behave accordingly. The Huffington Post, for its part, often seems like the house organ for the Democratic Party, or at least some broad cross-section thereof. I actually just asked the same question of MSNBC, but how do you avoid becoming the Fox News of the left?
I actually think that we have completely avoided that, very simply by putting a high premium on accuracy, fact-checking, fairness, posting things that are newsworthy, even though they may hurt someone that we clearly prefer, at least I do, in the case of Barack Obama, for example.
In writing this book, Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America and so forth, what are you accomplishing? I mean, I don't think Dick Cheney is going to read the book and undergo a conversion experience. And you're not covering a whole lot of ground that isn't covered day to day in the Huffington Post or by Keith Olbermann or Pacifica Radio or Maureen Dowd or a whole lot of the blogosphere. Apart from catharsis and rage, why write this book?
I really wrote the book not really to catalog what has happened, but to understand why. Because I think if we're going to put an end to this dark chapter in American history, we need to understand why. And you're absolutely right. The 28% of Americans who still approve of George Bush are not going to be in any way influenced by my book. But there is another 20% that I do want to appeal to, and that's the 20% of additional Americans who make the 48% that are considering voting for John McCain. If that 20% reads my book, and at the end of it they're still thinking of voting for John McCain, they can have their money back.
So the answer to my question is that you wrote this book to make sure that John McCain is defeated?
Yes.
All right, just one more question. Are you Ginger or Marianne?
Can I be both?
Well, that's not for me to judge. Arianna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Arianna Huffington is author of Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe, and What You Need to Know to End the Madness. And it would probably have had a longer title, but they ran out of cover. Thanks again, Arianna.
Thank you.
And now a few of your letters. In our interview with New York Times Magazine columnist Virginia Heffernan, we discussed Japan's souped-up version of the Internet Cafe, what Heffernan calls the Media Immersion Pod. Suta Bia from Seoul, South Korea, wrote on our website that the pods offer more than just media. Quote, "The most interesting aspect is the sleeping rooms, where you might stay and sleep or bring a friend and engage in any number of nocturnal activities." The letter is unspecific, but probably the reference is to shortwave radio or stargazing. Ron Bean from Wisconsin wrote in after we re-aired a segment about the e-ink technology used in e-readers, devices some think will eventually replace old-fashioned paper. Says Bean, when I buy a paper book, my ownership of that copy is absolute. The seller can't revoke it or prevent me from reading it or referring back to it in the future. When you buy an electronic book that has any kind of digital rights management, you're really just renting it. Inevitably, there will be times when your only recourse will be to buy another copy. Also, regarding our failure to find someone who had read Tolstoy's epic novel War and Peace, D. Douglas of San Francisco was skeptical that the thousand-some pages of War and Peace were the barrier. Quote, I can't help but wonder how many of the people who say they've never read War and Peace regularly read novels of any kind. Maybe, although most of our novel-loving staff hasn't read it either. But we do read all of your letters. Keep emailing us at onthemedia@wnyc.org or leave comments on our website. Click on the comment icon under each segment at onthemedia.org. Coming up, a picture is worth a thousand words, but sometimes a thousand aren't nearly enough. A second look at the trophy photos of Abu Ghraib. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Thursday of this week, the five men accused of the murder of 2,973 people on September 11th were formally charged at a Guantanamo Bay military tribunal. The arraignment had been widely reported as a significant legal moment, a test for the entire military tribunal system. But the arraignment of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four alleged co-conspirators was also a major media moment and a problematic one at that. The throngs of press who poured into Guantanamo to cover the arraignment have access to very little information, and much of what they have access to is censored. The Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg joins us from Gitmo. Carol, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Describe the scene. It's rustic, is it not?
Well, you know, no self-respecting journalist wants to be used as a Pentagon prop in a transparency talking point, but they've put up tents. And they're putting the media in the tents. The lawyers rebelled against it, so they got a trailer park. And the judges and the jurors, they drive past the McDonald's and the mini golf course and over past the church to quite nice townhouses. So what you see on TV are reporters standing up in what looks like an expeditionary setting. They call it Camp Justice. But it doesn't look like the rest of the base that we've been coming to at all for the past 6 years.
Now, I know, because we've discussed this previously, that you don't want to come off as whining about rough accommodations in a situation where the detainees have been locked up in Guantanamo. But you think that in the medium there is a message. What is the government's message here?
You're right. No one should be whining. The detainees have gone from cages over at Camp X-Ray to air-conditioned steel and cement boxes. But I do think there's a message in how they're accommodating people down here. What they say is that this is the battlefield, and this is an outpost in the global war on terror. And so when you have Fox and CNN standing up and reporting, I think they prefer to have three or four tents in the background with flags flapping in the breeze rather than, you know, another shot with, like I said, McDonald's in the background.
Justice by the tribunal, set design by the Pentagon.
As it were.
Tell me about the job of reporting itself. The testimony is heavily censored, and the description of what you have access to sounds positively Byzantine. Tell me about it.
It's a struggle. They've created this court so that they can have national security evidence inside it, which means that the judges can hear it, the prosecutors, even the defense attorneys, if they get their secret clearances, can hear it. And they've told us that, you know, the detainees can see top security information. So we're sitting here, And, for example, Ramzi bin al-Shib, who said that he wanted to be a martyr on 9/11, make no mistake about it, he said he just couldn't get a visa, launched into a description of what kind of psychotropic drugs he's taking here at the prison camps or being given here at the prison camps. And the media monitors hit the white noise button. We didn't get to hear what exactly he's being given, and we didn't exactly hear his explanation about why he's on medication. And one of the escorts here explained that this was HIPAA protection, the Health and Information Protection Act, on a place where the Bush administration says the Constitution doesn't apply.
You know, I'm laughing. I'm not sure it's funny. It's absurd.
It's
really hard
sometimes
bizarre.
To be a journalist here because you can't laugh at those sorts of things.
You've talked about the stage setting. There have been other theatrics as well on both sides of this prosecution. Can you give me a bit of the spectacle that has taken place?
We had Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who supposedly has confessed after CIA waterboarding to carrying out September 11th to having personally, this is tough, beheaded the Wall Street Journal correspondent Daniel Pearl. And yesterday, when he was asked whether he understood the consequences of his trials was a death penalty, he said he welcomed martyrdom. One of the accused yesterday was Walid bin Attash. He supposedly trained in a terror camp, some of those guys who hijacked the plane on September 11th. He told the judge he wanted to be his own lawyer. And then when they were discussing sort of the timetable for the trial, he very politely asked a question, and it was this. After we are executed here at Guantanamo, will we be buried here or will we go home?
I want to ask you this. Presuming that these, in fact, were the perpetrators of 9/11, justice has finally, you know, taken them to the end of that road. And at the same time, the Bush administration is winding down to its conclusion. It all seems like a last chapter in many ways, but tell me, is there an epilogue that we can expect for this story?
Right now, the idea is if the Pentagon prosecutor has this trial on track, we are going to have the 9/11 trial smack in the middle of the presidential elections starting on September 18th. So you never know how it's going to end. You just know that the next chapter is going to be just as difficult and complicated to cover as the last one.
All right, Carol. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Carol Rosenberg is at Guantanamo Bay covering the arraignment of 9/11 suspects for the Miami Herald. The capture, interrogation, and incarceration of war on terror detainees has been, in many ways, a tortured path. The administration's waterboard first, answer questions later approach to U.S. law and the Geneva Conventions has yielded constant controversy and national shame, not least the scandals of Abu Ghraib, the Iraq prison where in 2004 photographs taken by soldiers revealed widespread prisoner abuse. The stars of many of the images were soldiers clowning in the midst of the horror, but what actually did those pictures reveal about Abu Ghraib? Here from a new documentary is military policewoman Sabrina Harmon reading from a letter she wrote home long before the trophy snapshots went public.
October 1st, 2003. First day at the prison. It's 9 p.m. and we can hear shots. No white lights are allowed to be on at night. No leaving the building after dark. I hope we ain't here long. I have a bad feeling about this place. The prison is called Abu Ghraib. 30,000 people were murdered here.
A woman struggling, to say the least, with her environment. Yet Harmon was the soldier seen in several snapshots with an ironic grin and silly thumbs-up gesture. How to reconcile what we've just heard with the grotesque images we've all seen? To author Philip Gurevich, who collaborated with filmmaker Errol Morris on a book about Abu Ghraib, the answer lies in the very title of their project, Standard Operating Procedure. Philip, welcome.
It's good to talk to you.
Abu Ghraib burst into the Western consciousness 4 years ago as some sort of inner circle of POW hell, but In Iraq, it had long since inspired fear and loathing. What was the place before the American occupation?
It was the central prison of Saddam's gulag. The word is used advisedly. He ran his prisons on a kind of Stalinist model and imprisoned all sorts of people, not just common criminals, but obviously lots of people whom he considered political criminals or opponents or intellectuals or free thinkers of any kind. It was a key mechanism of his power and control, having this terribly feared and terribly cruel prison system. At Abu Ghraib in particular, there was a death house where on average at least 100 people a week were put to death, and at times for any reason, from wanting to relieve overcrowding to the whim of one of Saddam's sons, Uday Urkuse, who would come through, you might suddenly have a spike in executions where it would be decided that it was time to kill 1,000. So it was known as this dreaded place of no return or place of great despair where people disappeared.
So the very name Abu Ghraib would have a chilling effect to any Iraqi long before the American invasion. Was it for that reason or more mundane ones that the coalition decided to make it the hub of its security interrogations?
On the contrary, it was despite an awareness of its symbolic significance. There was some serious discussion about the fact that, you know, what are we doing putting people in Abu Ghraib? We came here as liberators. We came here to put an end to Saddam's reign of terror. And so why are we reopening this place? And the feeling was, well, we're reopening it because it's the only really plausible facility for incarcerating large numbers of people. And at that point, they were starting to really round up large numbers of people. And the cell block where the infamous photographs were taken was reserved for prisoners who were deemed to be high-value detainees, prisoners who were pending or during interrogation by military intelligence, the CIA, and other intelligence organs of the United States.
Okay, let's talk about those photographs. What is maybe most intriguing is that the torturers chose to take snapshots of the fun to begin with. It's not just that the treatment was brutal, but that in the images that we have seen, the brutes seem to convey the gravity of a frat house pledge prank. And I'm wondering, where does that come from? Is it mob psychology? Is it wartime depravity? Is it the banality of evil? Is it hatred? Is there another explanation?
The photographs were taken for a variety of different reasons because they were taken by a variety of different people. Some of the earliest photographs that were taken at the prison showed only Iraqi prisoners. They never showed any American soldiers alongside these prisoners, smiling or unsmiling, doing anything to them or not doing anything to them. These photographs were taken mostly by Sabrina Harmon, a very low-ranking soldier who aspired to be a forensic photographer, a crime scene photographer in her civilian life. And she said she started to take photographs because she wanted to record what startled and surprised her when she arrived at Abu Ghraib and found it happening. She wanted to record what was allowed. That was her phrase. And she wrote home about this and explained in these letters her misgivings and her desire to record some of these things. And these photographs are startling because they show prisoners naked, trussed in extremely painful stress positions, standing in puddles of water, chained to the bars of their cells, with panties on their heads. You see these hellish poses, and you realize they have the quality of photojournalism. They're something that somebody glimpsed and took a snapshot of. They are not triumphalists. They are not trophy photographs. They have no discernible attitude whatsoever. Incidentally, none of those photographs became the iconic photos, and none of those photographs ever became the occasion for prosecution, because unless there was an American soldier in it, nobody really cared about it, and it was described as standard operating procedure.
Specialist Harmon was sending these photos back home, expressing shock at what was routine at Abu Ghraib, and yet the same woman is seen in one of the photos giving a kind of ironic, almost preening thumbs-up sign, which was, suffice to say, in sharp relief to the horror of what else was in the picture. And yet you say even that picture does not necessarily convey what is really going on, that there's a backstory to it.
Well, there are several photographs of Sabrina Harmon giving the thumbs up and smiling in front of prisoners. In one of the most striking ones, she's doing so in front of a corpse. And people, when they first saw that photograph, I think widely assumed that somehow or other she was gloating over the existence of this corpse and probably had a hand in its becoming a corpse. In fact, this is a prisoner who died under interrogation by a CIA interrogator 16 hours earlier at the prison and had been put on ice in a body bag while they tried to figure out how to dispose of the body. And she took a series of photographs where she started to peel back the body bag and peel back the ice bags and noticed that the body had been treated not before its death to cover its wounds and bandage and help its wounds, but after its death to cover up its wounds. And she was peeling these back and taking increasingly detailed kind of evidentiary photographs. When she was finished, Charles Grainer, who was in there with her, asked her to take a picture of him with the corpse. And then he said, I'll take one of you. And she, every time that she appeared in a picture in Iraq, not only at Abu Ghraib, but even in places where you wouldn't notice that it seemed strange, always struck the identical smile and thumbs up.
So it's a kind of a reflex or a signature part of her album of experience in Iraq.
I mean, honestly, it reminds me of nothing so much as certain politicians who always have the same smile. Certain people, a camera points at them and they acquire the same face each time. You see her there next to this man who's been murdered. The army rules it a homicide. It's very distracting that there's this woman grinning there. In the meantime, she created the only body of visual evidence that we have of a murder that was systematically covered up by the army and has never been prosecuted.
I understand you have listened to hundreds of hours of interviews with these soldiers. And I certainly understand why you'd be concerned that the media and the world at large have been distracted by a relatively trivial side issue to the systematic abuse of prisoners by the American military. I get both of those things. But I'm concerned that you will sound like you have been sold a bill of goods by the perpetrators themselves, that by expressing their ambivalence, they have somehow talked you out of their own culpability. Has that happened?
To try to explain and understand what's going on is not to form an apology for them. Because if, in fact, what the evidence shows us is that some of these prison guards were taking pictures to help show something. In one set of photographs, the pictures were taken in order to show those photographs to medics and to JAG lawyers in the military and ask them, is this okay? Is this okay? When you start to understand those things, you start to realize that there is more to the story than the photographs. And that's why it's important not to be fully distracted by the fact that, yes, indeed, some of them used photography as the occasion for posing and made a spectacle of themselves around this abuse, which suggests that they never grasped the gravity of it. And perhaps they could both grasp the gravity of it, be disturbed by it, and at times goof around with it. That's what I would say I saw in the photographs after hearing and studying the stories and the policies.
So in a way, what you're suggesting is what at first seemed to be a PR nightmare for the administration actually turned out to do them quite a service.
When they first were released in the press, we, broadly speaking, the public and the press, saw them as an expose and saw them as a damning indictment of something that embarrassed not just a small group of soldiers. These pictures became iconic, not of Charles Grainer, not of Lindy England, not of the Bad Apples. When people marched around the world and held these photographs up, they were symbols of something that America was doing as a matter of policy, not what a couple kids from West Virginia were doing as a prank. And we know that. That's what their power was. They were on the cover of The Economist magazine, The Hooded Man, the caption, Rumsfeld Resign. The sense that these photographs were a shame to an administration and to a policy was clear at first. And then they served exactly as you're saying. It became a way of containing the problem. And the administration was able to say, look at these depraved individuals. Nobody who wasn't in a photograph was prosecuted. No act that was photographed that didn't include a soldier became the cause of an investigation that led to a prosecution. Nobody over the rank of staff sergeant gets prosecuted. And the administration, meanwhile, as we know, and as they openly admit and have tried to make an enduring part of their legacy, continues to pursue a policy of decriminalizing many practices that had been seen as torture everywhere else in the world and in our own country until very recently. And so far from exposing something larger, they actually distract and cover up the story that they seem to lead us toward.
Philip, thank you.
Thank you.
Philip Gurevich is a staff writer at The New Yorker and co-author with filmmaker Errol Morris of Standard Operating Procedure. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Nadia Zonis, and edited this week by committee. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh and Paul Schneider. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. And email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.